Greetings, fellow traveler. As humanity awakens and evolves, we see change in every aspect of our lives. Let's consciously manifest our desires. I am Candace Craw Goldman, and this is New Earth Journey.
Greetings. Thanks for joining us today. Today is the 8th of December, 2015, and it's going to be a really fun night for me because I'm welcoming a really wonderful friend of mine, my personal veterinarian and very good friend, Dr. Jessica Harrison. Jessica is a graduate of Andover Central High School, which is here in Kansas, and she was born and raised in this area. And she's the daughter of Dr. Reed Harrison. And Reed was the veterinarian for my family when I was growing up here in Rose Hill, Kansas. And they're the owners of the Rose Hill Veterinary Clinic. And Jessica spent her fair share of time in and around the clinic. And she fell in love with animals and people and veterinary medicine, just like her dad. And one of the best things about Jess is she also has a love for horses like I do. So we have a lot of things in common. Jessica spent most of her childhood years showing American saddlebreds. In 2003, she rode for Team USA in South Africa. I never knew you went to South Africa. At the Saddle Seat World Cup Invitational. And she also won several world and national titles here in the United States. In 2007, she received a Bachelor of Science in Biology from Kansas State University and met the lovely and wonderful Dr. Brian Hodes, who's sitting across from us now in the living room, who is now her husband. And so both Jessica and Brian attended Kansas State University's College of Veterinary Medicine together. And they graduated in May of 2011. And I remember that because I got here in 2010. And your dad was like, another year, Jessica's going to be here. She's going to be your vet. While in veterinary school, Jessica focused her efforts on equine medicine and surgery and studied as much equine coursework as she could. And in the fall of her senior year, she was selected as Kansas State University's veterinary student representative to work alongside the veterinarians in charge of the All-Tech FEI World Equestrian Games in Lexington, Kentucky. So when you were there with all those other photographers, buds of mine, you were rubbing shoulders when I was doing equine photography. I didn't even know it. She was also an extern at several major equine referral practices, including Rood and Riddle Equine Hospital in Lexington, Kentucky, and Glenwood Veterinary Hospital in Glenwood Springs, Colorado. Welcome, Jessica.
Thanks, Candace. I'm very excited.
Well, you know, this is just so much fun for me. You know, when you were in the other room, I actually asked Brian, I was like, now, how old are you guys anyway? And I was doing the math. And so you were born in 85.
Yes, ma'am.
So your dad was standing in the driveway of my parents' home and my own home when I was living there. I must have been 17. So it must have been, you know, it was in the late 1970s, I guess, when he saved my mare from colic. You weren't even born yet.
Oh, yeah. No, you're right. I wasn't because he graduated vet school in 79.
Right, which is when I graduated high school.
Yeah, get out. Wow.
Yeah. So this happened, even before you were a gleam in your daddy's eye.
I know. I think that's a really cool connection.
You know, I loved your dad that day. There are many things that stand out in my mind. Of course, the very best and happiest thing is that my mare lived through the crisis and she was fine. But I remember that your dad was very kind. He was very much in control of the situation. And when I asked him, when I got the courage to ask him if my horse's name was Money, and I said, is Money going to make it? And he said, I'll never forget it. I mean, I can even show you the place in the driveway where all this happened. It was so burned in my mind. And he looked at me and he said, I don't know. You know, I don't know yet. Mm-hmm. We'll see. And I remember really appreciating how honest he was, even to, I mean, you know, think about it. I was a young girl. I mean, I was a teenager, and obviously totally in love with my horse. And I know you know what that
is. Oh, yes, definitely. Absolutely.
So tell me what it was like growing up with, and your mom worked at the clinic. Mm-hmm. Yep. And so you just, probably some of your earliest memories are showing up at the vet clinic doing stuff, right? So like, right. What are some of your earliest memories? Like you must have been, what, two or three, oh. Maybe when you're remembering things,
oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I do. I'm lucky enough that I can remember a lot of those. So, I mean, in a veterinary clinic, obviously, I mean, a lot of people think, you know, puppies and kittens. And there is obviously quite a bit of that. Or I mean, that's one of the highlights of the job. But, I mean, surgery, you know, sterile technique, you know, things need to be kept a certain way to perform surgery on animals. And a two-year-old is not very conducive to that. And I'm sure if you talk to any veterinary, I mean, Brian's dad too, will tell you similar stories. But one of my earlier memories was, and there really is no other way to word this. Just bear with me. This is what came out of a two-year-old's mouth. My dad, this is one of my dad's favorite stories to tell about me too. I would get a step stool, cause I actually did. One of my favorite things was to watch him perform surgery. So he would get me a step stool and he would set it up to where I could not touch anything because, of course, two-year-olds like to touch everything and that would completely ruin the whole sterile technique idea. So he would give me my little step stool and I would crawl on my step stool and basically get in my position, my observation area, and I would watch, and no matter what procedure he was doing, I would literally say, and again, to me, this is like mortifying, but my parents think it's hysterical. I would literally crawl up there and say, oh, what, are we going to cut his blood out today?
Oh my gosh.
Which is like terrible, but I think in my mind, like I had really no concept of exactly what was going on. It's just that, you know, he would touch the dog and then it would, you know, bleed. And I, you know, as a kid, I didn't see that as a, you know, scary or bad process. I saw it as somewhat magical. So there were a few times though, and this is where this other memory is going. I would not stay on my stool and I would go and maybe put my hand on the surgery tray or attempt to help. And so that resulted in basically me getting put in one of the ER cages for the cats and the dogs. And so where I would be told to pretend to be a cat or a dog. I mean, my dad would give me a little water bowl and a little food bowl and I would make believe that I was a cat. And I would literally stay in there for hours and have no problem make believing that I was a cat or a dog. However, I did also develop a taste for dog and cat food, which was much to the not so good for the digestive tract of a two-year-old, but I liked the taste. So much to my mom's dismay, I would come home with some GI upsets to which my dad would get ridiculed for allowing me to eat those things. But apparently it occupied me while I was pretending to be said cat in the cage. And okay. I definitely remember that because I would have cousins. I'm one of 28 cousins and all but two are girls and we're all relatively close in age. And so there were several that would, I would play with when I was growing up and they'd come to the clinic too. And we'd just all hang out in the cat cages. So we would, you know, be out of the way. We'd be at the clinic. We'd be, you know, monitored, but I mean, we'd all just get to go play in the cat cages and playing make believe in the cat cages was probably one of my favorite things when I was a little kid.
I can't believe I never heard that story.
I know.
Especially
because I find it very much embarrassing, but
and yet you're saying it on live radio.
I know, right? But here I thought I was like unique in that aspect, and almost every other person, other veterinary colleague I've had that was also a vet's kid has eaten their fair share of animal food.
Isn't that interesting? And even played in cages. You know, we used to play. My brother and I have very few photos of him and I as children, but one of my favorites is where I've got some felt ears on my head and on a headband and some whiskers painted on my nose and face. So we played kitty and my own children play Kitty.
Absolutely.
And you just got to play Kitty, like, with some real props.
Although, yeah, I know.
I have to say, I never did the Friskies thing.
So. No, and I don't recommend it. Luckily we moved past that food
craving.
That's
hysterical. So as you were growing up, obviously you grew out of some of that, but at some point, did you start to be, because, you know, kids, especially if they have a real interest, and of course you mm-hmm. adore animals, at some point you actually could have been a fetch and carry and kind of helpful around the clinic. Is that the way that worked, like after school or whatever?
Yeah, absolutely. I probably wouldn't consider myself as being useful until probably like maybe middle school, like partway through middle school and like high school, obviously undergrad and in college. So I started out just doing, you know, kennel work, you know, walking the dogs, cleaning the runs, taking care of them, holding animals, just basically being a veterinary assistant, which I really enjoyed. And it's, moving kind of from just the kennel area to actually getting to come up front and help, help with the front desk, help hold in exam rooms. And I mean, that's where you really get to start to talk to clients too. And I think that's when I started to really, really enjoy this business even more. Cause I do, I absolutely love animals. I think they're incredible, but they, you know, they all come attached to equally amazing people. And to me, that's one of my most favorite parts about this business is, the people part. I mean, I absolutely love people just as much as I do animals. And I think in order to do this business, you have to be that way. We get a lot of, so we offer a lot of opportunities for students to shadow us and, interns, externs, be they from vet school, people who are graduating vet school to people who are in undergrad to, high school students that don't even know if this is really what they want to do. And we have so many of them that come and say, well, you know, I don't really like people, so I just want to work on animals. And I always tell them, you know, that's not, you know, ideally that we need to kind of change that or possibly look at a different career, because, you know, I've yet to have a dog walk into my clinic with its own, you know, credit card saying, here, please spay me. or I mean, like a horse, like, well, I'm colicking, I need you to help me out. Mm-hmm. I mean, they very much come attached to the person, and that's a big part of it, obviously, not just for the monetary reasons, but I mean, that human animal bond to me is what's really amazing. There's just been too many awe-inspiring stories that I've seen with people and their animals, be they a chinchilla or a horse, dog or cat, what have you. It's just that animal human connection is amazing. And I've met some really amazing people through their pets. So
mm-hmm. Chinchilla, I was just thinking, I'm not sure I've ever held a chinchilla before. Okay. So let's start with that. What's the strangest animal or most surprising animal you've ever seen walk through the clinic doors?
Oh man. We work on quite a few. That's part of the reason that we operate the way we do, and it is fairly unique because we don't just see dogs and cats. We don't just do dogs, cats, horses, and cattle. I mean, we literally will work on everything. We've got one. He's actually a vet student right now. Hopefully, we'll come back to work with us. But he has all different kinds of ornate, like turtles and tortoises. Sugar gliders are becoming pretty popular. We have a lady that has a bobcat.
I love that.
Yeah, actually, she's got two bobcats.
Have you seen
there are two clients with bobcats?
Have you seen those great big? What are those African kind of cats? Those really big cats?
Yeah, like servals.
Yeah,
yeah.
Do you have any of those?
I don't think
if
so.
If somebody walks into your clinic,
you want to see
it. you text me right away.
I would absolutely text you.
Have you seen one of those before?
Yeah, they're incredible. I have not pet one. No. No, probably this was outside of my own personal clinic, but probably one of the neatest things I got to do was perform an ultrasound guided cystocentesis, which is a fancy word for taking a urine sample out of the bladder on a snow leopard at the Manhattan Zoo while I was on a clinical rotation.
Oh my gosh.
He was anesthetized, but that to me, I was just like,
must have had big old paws.
Huge. Yeah. They've got such, I mean, they just look like a bit, obviously they can kill you, but I mean, they just look like, they just look so cuddly. And so it was just a neat, just an amazing experience to be able to work with an animal like that. I mean, this is such a cool profession because, you know, just because it's a snow leopard doesn't mean it's like we have to change all of our procedures. I mean, there's a lot of comparative things mm-hmm. That allow us to treat multiple animals. And that's why mm-hmm. we like to do that. As far as the most strange animal. I would probably say we have one family, and their kids, as part of kind of their, you know, their responsibilities, they decided to do a little petting zoo. And they have got a large collection of some interesting animals, including a rose tarantula. And I'm not a spider person, so that was a little difficult to look at. Luckily, they were just bringing him in for health checkups, and tarantulas, fortunately, do not have a whole lot of health issues. So we just
got to look at,
yeah, exactly. But they've got all kinds of different reptile species, birds. Birds are actually one of my more favorite things to work on, especially the really large parrots, macaws. And
well, on the YouTube replay that we'll put up, I have some pictures of all of you with this bird. Who is that bird, and what kind of bird is that? I showed it to my mother today.
Yeah, good.
And Mom said, well, that's a parakeet. I'm like, that is no parakeet.
No,
it is.
No.
First off, look at its beak. Second off, it's much bigger.
So yes. So he has a very good story. That is Maxwell. Maxwell is an African gray parrot of the Congo variety. So they actually come in two different varieties, and he's the larger one. African grays are amazing birds. Now, they tend to only like one or two people, which he does. That's definitely Brian or Dad's bird. He will, I can get him out, but he does not like
me. Where does he live then?
He lives in his big cage in Dad's office.
How come I didn't know this?
Well, I'll have to bring you back and meet him.
It's like some sort of secret corner or
it
something.
It is.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
I know, right? No, it's not a secret corner, but I will definitely bring you back to meet him. So he loves Brian and Dad. African grays are, so there are parrots that talk and there are parrots that can imitate noises. He can do both, but African grays are much, much better at actually mimicking noises. So he can make over 20 different cat noises because the cat room is right next door to him. He can imitate my dad to a T, so that if you are in the cat room and Dad is not in there, he will cough just like my dad makes a cough.
Oh my gosh.
And act like he's answering a phone just like my dad does, to the point where you kind of have to open the door and be like, is he in here or is that the bird? And it's usually
That's
the bird.
Hysterical.
Any car that pulls up outside the clinic, he can mimic that. He's actually, he's been pretty funny because he will, you may not know that he's actually picking up on exactly what you're saying. So for instance, he's a little bit of a rat because if an employee has gone back there to have, you know, maybe a little venting session with somebody else, he'll repeat it.
Oh my gosh.
And he tends, it's amazing how quick they can pick it up. So a lot of people that train birds to talk about, you know, it sometimes can take several days, maybe even weeks for them to learn a new phrase. Mm-hmm. If it is Brian, Dad, or Ryan, our student that's at vet school right now, Ryan taught him an entire phrase in maybe less than an hour. And Brian has taught him a few things in 5 minutes, to which Brian leaves and I'm stuck in there with the bird, and he proceeds to start doing exactly, saying exactly or
the
mimicking
shtick.
What Brian, yes, exactly. So
does he keep the four letter words out of it, or does he
No, he doesn't, because his previous owner, and it may have been two owners ago, we don't really know his full story. We know he's banded and he was bred in captivity. But outside of that, he basically was in a house fire. And so came to stay at the clinic because the house was destroyed and his owner never came back to get him. So
wow.
We didn't want to, and they're tricky birds, and they live for a very long time.
Right.
So they're a pretty big responsibility.
Right.
They need a very large cage. They're incredibly destructive if they don't get the right amount of activity. They're very intelligent. I know a lot of people think birds cannot use their phrases in context. I completely disagree with that. That bird knows exactly what he's doing.
That's amazing. Wow. I'm going to have you over here to do more shows. I am learning.
I know,
some,
right?
Not even just about the animals, but about you. Okay. So the next question I have is, I'm sure at some point while you were growing up, you would be telling your parents, your dad, that you wanted to be a vet.
Mm-hmm.
When did you really know that was true? And when did they really know that was true? Or has it always been true?
It really always has been. In fact, I don't know if that's because neither of my parents really ever, you know, pushed me like, gosh, you're going to be a vet and take over the family business, blah, blah, blah. They never, ever did that. I mean, they were incredibly supportive in, you know, whatever endeavor I wanted to do. But I distinctly just remember always wanting to be a vet. I mean, really from probably the time I was like 5 or 6 years old, I just really wanted to do that. And to the point of in eighth grade, we were doing a heart dissection with my science class, and three of the girls got quite squeamish. One of them fainted, and the other two got quite pale. And I had never even, I mean, I've been watching this stuff since I was a little kid, so it never bothered me. But what bothered me was watching a human faint. And that made me lightheaded to the point where I thought I was, I didn't realize that's what it was at the time. I thought I was also, you know, eked out by the heart, which is ridiculous because So, but I literally at that point, I distinctly remember coming home and I was very upset because I was like, well, that's it. I don't know what I'm going to do now because I apparently can't take blood. So I can't be a veterinarian. And I just was crying and so upset. And you know, my dad was like, that's all in your head. He's like, you will be fine. He's like, you just can't sit there and think about it. And I mean, we see it in vet school too. I mean, we're obviously all there to be veterinarians, and inevitably somebody gets nervous standing there, you know, being the assistant surgeon, and they lock their knees and basically quit breathing and they just pass out. So, I mean, it happens for multiple different reasons. And, you know, I kind of figured out my own way around that. I still, to this day, do not like human medicine was not for me. I love humans, but working on animals is definitely where I needed to be. Because to this day, watching a human pass out will sometimes send me thinking the same direction.
This reminds me of a story. I know that you had a small injury with your fingers on a horse,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And there was some, and you had to hide it from yourself so that you wouldn't.
So I didn't see. Yeah, you were exactly right.
So you couldn't take a human fainting, and you certainly weren't going to be able to really face your own.
No,
self.
No. To this day, I mean,
cutting the blood out of yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I'm not okay with that. No, literally to this day, like if I have to, you know, if they have to take blood or something at a doctor's appointment, the needle doesn't bother me. The poking, that does not bother me a bit. I literally just cannot watch the process.
Interesting. Okay. Well, so here's a question for you, because this is where you and I spend so much time talking about is sort of new ways of thinking about, gosh, not only health and care of both people and animals, but really, you know, how reality is constructed. Mm-hmm. So, but to back that off into an easier maybe question to answer, I'd like to know from your perspective, because you've got an excellent one. You know, you've got Brian, you've got his family, you have your parents. How has veterinary medicine changed from the time your dad went to school compared to when you went to school? And then what sort of things are you learning that are just now coming on board that maybe even the current vet schools, you know, don't think about? Or what are some of the things that you think about? Because I know we talk about this stuff all the time.
Yes.
But what I'd love to know is how you, you know, are seeing this change in veterinary care over the last couple decades.
Gosh, it'd probably be easier to say how it hasn't changed. It's a bit, it's a wonderful, it's a really wonderful question because I mean, if you ask a vet student today, I mean, so vet school is based, no matter where you go, is still 4 years. I mean, it was 4 years for our parents. It's 4 years for us. And I mean, the, you know, medicine and the science of, you know, medicine and surgery has changed quite a bit. You know, we have so many new tools to use. And so truthfully, I think cramming it all into 4 years is eventually going to be, possibly something that changes. You know, they may have to extend it. So I think definitely cramming that all into one thing is difficult. There's definitely been a change in how we approach cases as far as, I think, you know, anytime a pet comes in, I think as a veterinarian, the job is, you know, diagnosis, prognosis, and cost. Those are the three things that, you know, folks really, I think, is our job to convey to them. But I think people nowadays, pet ownership has gone from, you know, I mean, back when my dad was in school, there was still a very large population that, you know, a cat or a dog was a farm cat and they were very easily replaced. So that was their mentality. And, you know, if they're easily replaced, no one's going to spend, you know, $200, let alone $1,500, on their barn cat or their farm dog. They just would go get a new one. And definitely over the years, that has changed big time. pets are now part of the family. I mean, they live indoors, they sleep in our beds. You know, they eat our food,
and vice versa.
And vice versa. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Some of us eat their food. But I think that's a big drive for the pet industry. And that's a reason why it's, you gotten the opportunity to advance so much more. I mean, you know, there are some, that's actually a big debate in vet med too. I mean, there are still some practitioners that are like, no, I don't think it ever needs to go the way of human medicine. These are not humans. And you know, while they're not, there are other ones who are like, nope, needs to go the same way as humans. We need to treat them exactly like humans. And, you know, whether one side is right or wrong, I think it still completely depends on exactly where you're practicing and who your clientele is. I mean, you know, there are always going to be people that own pets at both ends of the spectrum. So I think a big key also, so basically I think compassion is a big thing that we've had to move towards. I remember as a little kid, I would talk to equine veterinarians, and you know, I was scared of them because they were, you know, very, you know, they were quite frankly usually men. So that's been a big change. My dad had two women in his class. I had five men. Like, so
there were more women in your class.
Much more.
How big was your class?
115, I think. Yeah.
Two-thirds. Women.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. We had more than five, but I mean, it's distinctly an 85% field. And that has also changed because, I mean, yes, we're all equal, not to drum up that argument, but, there's more turnover, as far as veterinarians go. You know, back in the day, you know, with my dad, you become a veterinarian, you're a veterinarian for life. Nowadays, there's quite a few women veterinarians who start their career and they have kids. And quite honestly, some of them just stop and decide to raise their kids. And that's not bad. That's great. Except it does create higher turnover and more demand. So that actually was a good thing for vet students because that made more job opportunities. So quite a few differences there. The other thing I think it is really, really important that I see now, and probably a reason sometimes for a lot of second, third, fourth opinions, is truly open-mindedness. And that's an important topic to me because I think that's also why you and I are usually on the same page. You know, and there are lots of things that they teach you in vet school, and you know, this is not an exact science, and that to me is a very, very important part of it. We may think we know everything about it, but I've seen way too many instances to be like, nope, apparently we really don't. And in my opinion, I mean, we take an oath that says do no harm. And so, I mean, if there's a treatment out there that can help an animal, and it's, you know, not, I mean, it's not clearly not going to harm it, it can only help. I really don't see the point in not at least trying it, especially if it's in the animal's and the owner's best interest. And that doesn't matter if it's a cattle on a cow calf farm, if it's, you know, your pet dog, your pet cat, your show horse, your companion horse, either way. So I think that's why alternative therapies like chiropractics, like acupuncture, Reiki, a more holistic approach with some practices, I think that's why those are gaining ground. Because quite frankly, they do work. Do we know how? No. And that's scary to a lot of people who really need to know exactly how things work. But we have to remember too, I mean, when they first found penicillin, they knew it worked, but they didn't know why. I mean, that was quite a magical elixir at the time. And now we know how it works. So, I mean, will we eventually know how some of these things work? Maybe. But the point is they certainly can help, and they're great adjunctive therapies. One of my favorite examples is truthfully lameness in horses. Chiropractics used to get poo-pooed. I am from a family that has both human medicine and vet med in it, and there was a lot of headbutting quite a few times. And one consensus was that chiropractic was a wash and really did nothing. And I personally have had enough experience with it that I completely disagree. Now, I do think there are instances where it's not going to be the, you know, cure-all, end-all to every case, but I have actually seen it be the cure-all for a case. So, I mean, nothing's exact. Not one thing is not going to be healed. There's no – my dad always has a funny joke about you know, everybody wants the one shot to cure everything, and there really is no super stericomb Vitavax Plus.
Whoa. Say that again. There's no.
So no super. Okay. So if you had, if they, They wanted him to come up as just a mock project in vet school, something that could, you know, cure everything. And one kid came up with this new product. Obviously, this is a joke,
right?
That was called. So what would that product be? Well, it would be injectable because, you know, if an animal bites or something, it doesn't matter. You can still get it in there. It's going to be amazing. It's going to be a vaccine. It's got to be sterile. Probably, and then it's got to treat, you know, whatever viral or bacterial disease you have. So they called it Super Steri Combi Vitavax Plus.
Oh, gotcha.
But then for those people that don't want to return, there's Depo Super Steri Combo Vitavax Plus. So that was kind of a joke. And obviously that doesn't exist. And, you know, probably it shouldn't exist. I think if we, you know, try to treat everything with one thing, that's not going to work. And I mean, we've seen that with the homeopathic therapies. We see that with everything. There's not one, you know, one thing to cure all, but there are certainly things as far as keeping an open mind. Those are definitely areas that I think are continuing to grow. I see more and more colleagues interested in those areas. I, for one, as far as chiropractics go, right now we have a gentleman that does a lot of the chiropractics work for us outside, but unfortunately he had to relocate and it's a little difficult to get him back here. So that's definitely an area that I am going to pursue further training in. So.
Are you? Mm-hmm. Where do you have to go for that?
It is actually a specific chiropractic training school for veterinarians outside the Kansas City area. So it's basically 1 week a month for 6 months. But wow. They've got a pretty amazing program. I've talked to four colleagues that have been through that program, and they were absolutely amazed with it and are very excited about their knowledge they gained from it. So pretty cool system.
That's really great. I love the idea that, we've been, sitting here chatting, Jessica and I, but actually we actually have another vet in the room. We have, Dr. Brian Hode and excuse me, gosh. And, now you guys met in veterinary school.
No, we met in our biochemistry lab in undergrad.
Okay, well, I'm going to turn the computer just a little this way because I want Brian to say hi. But let's see, I'm going to look at Brian's bio here, and I'm going to go ahead and introduce him because I would love for this to be sort of a semi-regular thing, all three of us here getting together and talking, and we Brian's over there, and I didn't know if he would just, twiddle his thumbs or go outside and pet the dogs or something, but no, I can tell he wants to be here and talk with us, so let's introduce him formally, shall we? So, Brian graduated from KSU in 2011, too. And in veterinary school, he completed externships in large animal medicine and surgery in Oklahoma and Kansas, and small animal medicine and surgery in New Jersey. Yep, I know about New Jersey too. And we like you anyway. Brian specializes in, and no offense out there, I've lived in New Jersey. I've met wonderful people out there. It's a joke. It's a joke. People. Brian specializes in large animal and especially the cattle and the alpaca, llama, goats, and sheep, variety of the large animals and small animals too, and surgery. And he was recently selected to be the veterinarian in charge at the Mopaca and Futurity Alpaca Shows. Is that why you were holding those alpacas in those pictures like that?
Yeah.
In Kansas City. And Brian is also certified ABBI veterinarian, which I have no idea what that is. Wow. And enjoys working on bucking stock. Seriously?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're talking let's welcome Brian. Hi, Brian.
Hello. Good to be here.
Yeah, let's see. Make sure you speak up because we this is like here's the microphone, so it's right into there. So like in the rodeos, like the saddle bronx and the bareback bronx and even the bulls.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have always wanted to know some stuff about that. Like, how do you float those guys' teeth? How do you even treat a wound? I mean, do you have to lock them into stocks for everything they do? Because I've watched the handlers and I've watched, you know, they don't want they don't want people petting them. You know, they want them to be wild. They don't want them to get all lovey-dovey with humans because they want them to be bucking stock.
When these animals are at the rodeo, it's business. These guys, these bulls and horses, they know what they're there for. You get them on their home territory where they're taken care of very, very, very well. They're not that nasty. A lot of these upper level bucking bulls, they've got a caretaker that can go on the pen and pet them. You watch these caretakers with these animals in a chute when we're working on them, pulling blood, just doing physical on them so they can travel state lines to go to different shows. That handler or owner is scratching that bull's back, is talking to them. I mean, they really do appreciate what these animals do for them, and they see that that's their livelihood, and they take very, very good care of them. So oftentimes dealing with them on their home area, it's not that big of a deal. Now you get to the rodeo where they're working, it's a whole different ballgame, and you use sedation and try to minimize their stress and where they are, give them as much space as they can, and let them do what they need to do. And 9 times out of 10, they do just fine.
You know, I am so happy to hear that because I spent many, many years being the official back of the shoots photographer at, you know, the Star of Texas Rodeo in Austin. And I loved that job, and I loved being back there with the cowboys and all of the bucking stock. And I could tell exactly what you said. You know, this is the job, and they know their job, and they even know how to get on the trailer. They know where to go in the pens. They're very smart animals. But I also know, and we're watching some of the handlers. You know, and they, you know, you're right. They're on. They're on. They aren't to be pet while they're there. But when they're at home, they're different. That's really great to hear. I'm happy to hear that. Because I don't really know anybody who – I mean, I know we've got places around here we have for ever since – you know, I can remember some of the Buck and Bull, the Sankey boys, right?
Yep.
I mean, they're probably – I think I drive by their place every once in a while. They seem to still be in business, right?
They are,
Yeah. So, you know, here's the really interesting thing for me. As we're talking about this, I'm reminded about – the fact that some of the, and this is going to get a little political here, but only vaguely, you know, some of the PETA people had a fit about what was going on at the rodeo. And from my perspective, and you tell me what you think, I think those fancy schmancy racehorses were treated a lot more cruelly in some instances than some, not all of them, but some of them. I think it's a perception, you know, it's this thing of cowboys getting on a bull and their spurs and they're bucking and there seems to be a battle going on there rather than
the PRCA, so professional rodeo circuit, they have very strict rules in how these animals are treated. They have to have a veterinarian on staff that's able to handle these animals, that if something goes wrong, I mean, they're athletes, they're going to blow ACLs. They're going to get hurt, but majority of the time, it's not a life-ending career for these guys. Sometimes it is, and it's an unfortunate part of the game these guys play, but it's the same thing that human athletes go through. I mean, the injuries are very similar. The risks that they take are very similar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also in response to your question, I mean, horse racing has definitely taken its own fair share of flack for some policies that probably should have been changed a while ago. Luckily, there have been quite a few changes to that, and hopefully, and there are quite a few people working on that going forward, as far as the racing industry goes. Because I mean, that's an incredibly elite athlete as far as racehorses go, and should be. I mean, they should definitely be cared for. Now, many of them, and I would venture to say most of them, truly are cared for better than a lot of humans out there. Unfortunately, but there's always going to be an error. I mean, no matter what sport you talk about, equine sports, dogs. I mean, human sports. There's always going to be somebody somewhere who is skimping or cheating to try to save a little bit. At the expense of their animals, and you just hope that those guys get caught
at some point from, you know, instituting policies. But I would completely agree with Brian. I mean, the PRCA is huge on the livestock. I mean, what a lot of people don't realize is, so a stock contractor is who owns all of those animals, whether it's the bucking broncs, whether it's the, you know, bulls, the steers, the calves, those are their livelihood. If those animals get hurt, they don't, I mean, they can't take them anymore. That's how they, I mean, that's how they make their money. So they got to take care of them. And, really, I mean, we've been fortunate, the stock contractors that we've gotten to work with take excellent care of their animals, which is, you know, really refreshing to see. You know, I wouldn't say that there's not somebody somewhere that maybe is not doing things the way we would like them to do. But as a whole, they really do a very nice job with regulating those areas now. A lot of improvements, especially in horse racing, horse showing. I mean, and not even those areas. I mean, you get into show jumping and dressage, saddle seat, quite a few more regulations coming along as far as showing those animals is concerned.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of good changes there.
And these animals, I mean, you know, a lot of performers, whether on the human side, you know, whether you're a singer, you know, whether Garth Brooks giving a concert, like he did most recently, or whether you're Michael Jordan playing basketball. I mean, you do it for the love of the game. And, you know, for the love of, you know, music, you know, whatever it is that you're doing. And I will absolutely say, and I know you've seen this too, and Brian's seen it. These animals actually really do love what they do. I mean, they know what applause is. They know what their job is. That bull knows that his job is to dump that cowboy, and he enjoys it. You know, and some of them are a little more on the aggressive side. But that's them at their job. I'm not going to lie. I've gone with Brian on some of his calls to do the bucking bulls. And I mean, there are a few that maintain a not so great attitude, but he's right. I mean, when they're at home, you can usually pet those guys. I mean, it's pretty cool. They're, you know, they're relaxed, but when they're working, they're working. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they're not, I mean, they're not to be, you know, cuddled and pet on. Mm-hmm. So I mean, it's just kind of, it's a very, very rewarding business to get to be a part of.
Brian, actually was thinking about you just yesterday driving home by this place where Tom and I had stopped. I think it was sometime in January of early this year. It was a terribly cold, bitterly cold day, and we saw a cow, and she had obviously just given birth. I mean, the afterbirth was hanging out of her, and there was, you know, the baby was separated, and I know how cold it was, and I remember we stopped and we looked for the owner, and it was pretty easy to find. It was adjacent, a pasture adjacent to a farmhouse, and we went over there and we knocked on the door, and we were like, you know, like that, and the guy's like, you know, your cow just gave birth over there, and he was just kind of like, yeah, so, and I was thinking, it's really cold, but anyway, he was like, okay, I'll go out there and see, but you know, my concern was they were far apart, you know, and we talked a little bit, and I don't even know if we asked you or how we found out about it, but I guess anymore, the cattle birthing season, dropping a calf happens all year long. Is that really true? What is going on there? Isn't that different than what it used to be?
It's less than ideal. Our goal is to have about a 60-day calving season in the spring and a 60-day calving season in the fall. 90 days isn't uncommon. These year-round calving makes it really difficult for management, makes it very difficult for productivity. It's very expensive for the farmer. So I think a lot of well-managed cow herds and more that's with what cow prices are, these animals have some value to them, and people treat them, I think, a lot better than probably they have been in the past. And so I think getting away from the year-round calving is definitely in these guys' benefit. And we've seen that more and more. And January calving is early spring calving, so it's not uncommon. But these guys usually are pretty on top of things. And if there's a calf that's born out in the snow or ice or rain or something like that, they'll get those animals up in their truck, in their house, in a bathtub, something to get them warm. I mean, there's been many nights where we've had neighbors that I've spent 3, 4, 5 hours with a calf that was born in the snow, and we brought the calf inside and started the fire and got a hot bath running for this newborn calf. And these people that say that farmers don't care about their animals, they don't know what they're talking about. I mean, I just day in and day out, these people just really appreciate what these animals do for them. And seeing PETA and ASPCA and a lot of these animals rights people, they have no idea what they're talking about at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's interesting. There's really, I mean, a newborn, I guess some of my questions are just very biological here at this point. I mean, a newborn calf being born like that, it really is at risk.
Yes.
Out in
yes.
the... And when, at what point can a newborn calf like that sustain its, I mean, I know they always need to be out of the wind if possible, yeah, and stuff like that, but at what point, I mean, is it a certain age that they can start, I mean, they just can't regulate their temperature right away,
usually,
right?
Pretty quickly.
Really? I mean, yeah. A newborn deer maybe,
yeah,
but a calf
they can.
Too.
Yeah, they can. They really don't have, if they can, if the mom can get them dried off, they don't have. They should not have any issue. And if they do, there's usually something wrong with either the cow or the calf.
So dry is the most important.
Yeah. Once
thing.
They're dry, they should be fine. In 90% of the cases.
Interesting. Well, I learned even more about that today. So, gosh, well, that's interesting. Well, we are coming down to towards the end of our show. But what I really want to talk about now, if you guys want to talk about. Because I've been excited about this for so long, and I want to hear more about it. Your new clinic.
Oh, yes.
let's talk about that.
Yeah, well, first of all, we'll give a little credit to the current building, because it certainly has allowed us to grow and start doing what it is we're doing. But
yeah.
Unfortunately, it's in the middle of town, which for all intents and purposes, my dad bought it. Back in, I think, 1982, and I think more in the spring. And actually, he and my grandfather, his dad, basically gutted it and made it into what it is today. It was a restaurant. They literally pulled down all the walls. Everything that you see is what my grandpa and my dad did, which is really cool. One exam room, one little surgery room. There's a little back part of it that our previous tenants had to go elsewhere because we grew so much that we needed to use the rest of the building. But he had three people that would run out the back half, and he just ran the clinic out of the front part of it. Smaller building, small parking lot, right next to the railroad tracks. So those come back when he built it, I think they came by like maybe once a day, and now they come by every 30 minutes. So that's a little difficult.
That is a busy railroad track because it goes by my studio.
Yes.
In the next town.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
And they do, and they fly by there. So, you know, inside the building, it's not quite as big of a deal, but we do not have a large animal hauling facility. All of our large animal work is mostly done by going on farm calls. So we usually go to our to the folks' house. And so basically whenever I've talked to anyone, they're like, you know, at what point do you decide to like, you know, remodel or build a new clinic? And they're like, when you absolutely cannot remodel anything else and you're completely bursting at the seams. And so what we did is we did a little remodel on the inside. We moved the surgery room to a larger area. We made a second exam room. And that was just probably a year and a half, 2 years ago. And now we've already outgrown that. And when we first started, when my dad started the practice in 82, it was a mixed animal practice. He saw everything. He very much likes horses. He's really not 100% like working on them. But obviously, I showed horses as a kid, still to this day, one of his favorite animals. But since he was just a solo practitioner, he was by himself, he kind of elected to just kind of turn away from the large animal stuff. He does like cattle reproduction, so he's always done that. But as far as large animal care, would refer that elsewhere and started doing just small animal. But Brian and I really like the large animal side, and we've always liked the idea of kind of one place to bring all of your pets. I mean, whether you see myself for one thing and Brian for something and Dad, or you see or all of them see one of us, we just kind of like to be one place that hopefully you can get all of your questions answered and we can take care of all of your pets. So that was kind of Brian and I's vision. And the current building, we have no large animal facility and we really weren't sure how it would take off. So we're like, well, you know what, let's just start it doing mobile work. When I was here and had horses as a kid, we used a separate veterinarian for my horses, and it's basically there have been changes to go on, and it became difficult to that guy unfortunately no longer practices, and so it became difficult to find someone that would come out. And I had heard that from other folks that I had ridden horses with, and so I was like, you know what, I think that's a good place to start, so we'll just start with ambulatory and see how it goes. And it has gone very, very well, but we've now reached the point where we do need a haul-in facility, and so we're going to do whole new building, not in the same place, that we're kind of landlocked in that site. And as far as moving, you know, equipment, large animal trailers in and out, it's pretty difficult right there, and there's really not a way to feasibly expand in our current site. So we found property. We'll probably start the whole process. We've kind of started the prelim stuff, but it's probably, we'll really be ramping up in January, and tentatively, hopefully, we'll be done spring, summer 2017. But, you know, in our ideal vision, we'll have a, you know, a new small animal clinic, and with also large animal capabilities too, medicine and surgery. So,
well, you know, your dad's single vet office now has turned into three.
Yeah.
And it must be so gratifying for him. So he's not done working.
No, he's, and that, you know, it's really fun because actually Brian's dad and my dad are both actually classmates from K-State Veterinary School. They were in the same vet school class too, which was kind of a cool thing. But I think Brian would agree with me. We're both pretty fortunate to have them as role models because they truly love their job. And I think, I mean, obviously you need to make money to pay your bills and keep a roof over your head and support your kids. But I think truly at the end of the day, if you really love what you do, you know, the rest of it just kind of comes together. And I think, I 100% foresee that my dad and Brian's dad will continue working until they absolutely cannot, because they love it, and they love it for the same reasons we do. You know, they obviously love animals, and they really like the people part. So I think that's important. And I mean, if someone comes in for an appointment, we always get people like, "Oh, I'm sorry, I've talked your leg off." And it's like, well, you know, you're paying us for an appointment, and we really like the people side, and you know, we like that part. That's why we do this job. I mean, we will even if we have a haul-in facility, we will still do farm calls, because it's such an important part. I know, right? I know, exactly. I know, because it's such an important part. And I mean, we would never be like, well, we have a new building now, so, you know, sorry to all of you that we were coming out to. No, because all those people are still going to be there, and they're the reason we get to do this. I mean, they're the ones that used us and, you know, called us out and allowed us to work on their pets. So, which is still amazing to me. I mean, it's so weird. I mean, especially when you grow up as your dad is the doctor, and then people start saying doctor, you kind of look around and they're like, oh, they're talking to me. it's an incredibly cool job. Absolutely love it. And no, dad will definitely still continue working. Absolutely.
How do you see, and truly we only have, you know, just 2 or 3 minutes left. How do you see what you offer to be special or unique in this area? And when I say this area, I look at your bio on here. You say that, you know, you pretty much take care of these counties. Butler County itself is the biggest. Isn't it the biggest county in the whole state of Kansas?
We have clients that drive from Kansas City to see us. We have clients that we deal with that have alpacas in Kansas.
We have clients in Kansas City that come to drive all the way to see us. We have clients that we deal with that have alpacas in Kansas City. We've got clients in Kingman in Oxford.
Wellington.
Huge area of this state. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we're happy to help everybody.
Yeah. So I think, to more answer your question, and we were both taught just by, you know, watching and, you know, watching other veterinarians. And I mean, my dad taught me, and I'm sure Brian learned the same thing from a young age, is, you know, you can learn something from everyone. And, you know, you may learn, hey, I want to do that. And you may learn, I'm never doing that.
Right.
But you really can learn something from everyone. And I think we have been very fortunate to be exposed to this, you know, this particular area in great detail. And we've had some amazing mentors that have helped us out along that path. And I would say, and even from talking to clients, and this is talking to people that have called us at 3 o'clock in the morning, and maybe they just got a question. And you know, we answer the phone. And I'm not saying that, you know, there haven't been times where I've missed a phone call from somebody because I'm either on the other line or, you know, obviously Verizon, the "Can you hear me now?" is not always 100% correct everywhere. But we truly try to be available to everyone. My Uncle Paul had a really good saying that I always thought was cool since I was a little kid. And, you know, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And so to take your pet in and just have a number, be assigned a number, is, I think, you know, a terrible idea. That's why, I don't mind if we spend an hour talking, you know, about your pet. You know, that's why we're here. That's what our job is. And so I think that compassion is hopefully kind of what sets us apart. I mean, we're available 24/7. We give our cell phone number out to our clients and we do emergency services. And I think that's a pretty good peace of mind for them. And we try to treat them as we would want to be treated in that situation.
Well, we are totally out of time now. So why don't you just, I know you have a website, but you don't have it here on your bio. Oh. What's your website so people can find you online?
So our website is also going to be new here in a couple years. But we needed a website, so this is what we started with. And the site will always be the same even when we update it. It's basically you go to www.rosehillvetclinic.com.
All right. Yeah, and in Rose Hill, Kansas, just find the railroad tracks.
You got it.
And Rose Hill Road.
For now.
And it's a great place, and many miracles have happened in that building, and I'm so happy to know this entire family. And, you know, this seemed like an introductory show. We didn't tell many stories, but, oh, my God, can we tell stories, right?
Yes.
I mean, we have so many stories about miraculous things and things we've discovered and ways animals have healed and new things, you know, new things about vet care, like different ideas about food and vaccinations, etc. But we are out of time this evening. I want to thank you both, Brian and Jessica, and I want to thank your dad too, even though he's not here. He's such
Absolutely.
A part of all of this.
Yep.
So thanks, Reed and Peggy too. And will y'all come back on another
Absolutely.
Tuesday, eat dinner, and then sit
yes.
here and chat like this?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, it was fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Okay. Good night. Thank you.